a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. That vast, high-velocity moral revolution that is reshaping modern cultures at warp speed is leaving almost no aspect of the culture untouched and untransformed. That's becoming increasingly clear. The advocates of same-sex marriage and the more comprehensive goals of the LGBT movement assured the nation that nothing would be fundamentally changed just if people of the same gender were allowed to marry one another. We knew that couldn't be true, and now the entire nation knows. The latest ground zero, of course, for this moral revolution has been the state of Indiana. You'll recall that just a matter of a few days ago, legislators there passed a state version of the federal law known as the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. Then Governor Mike Pence signed the bill into law. The controversy that followed was a free-for-all of misrepresentation and political posturing. Within days, the governor had capitulated to the controversy by calling for the law's revision, a revision that may well make the Indiana Religious Freedom Restoration Act a force for weakening religious liberty in that state rather than for strengthening it. Business, political, and civic leaders piled on in a massive act of political posturing. The Federal Religious Freedom Restoration Act, we should remember, became law in 1993 and another mass act, but that one of bipartisan cooperation. The act passed unanimously in the House of Representatives and with 97 affirmative votes in the Senate. You'll recall that President Bill Clinton signed the bill into law, celebrating the act as a much-needed protection of religious liberty. President Clinton called religious liberty the nation's first freedom and went on to state, and I quote, "We believe strongly that we can never be too vigilant in this work," end quote. But, as we have so often noted, that was then, but Indiana is now. Hillary Clinton, ready to launch her campaign for president, condemned the Indiana law as dangerous and discriminatory, even though the law in its federal form has not led to any such discrimination. That law, you will recall, that was signed into effect by her husband. Tim Cook, the CEO of Apple, took to the pages of the Washington Post to declare, in his words, that the Indiana law would, quote, "allow people to discriminate against their neighbors," end quote. For its part, the Washington Post itself published an editorial in which the paper's editorial board condemned a proposed law in the state of Georgia, a state version there, again, of the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, that would prevent the state government, quote, "from infringing on an individual's religious beliefs unless the state can demonstrate a compelling interest in doing so," end quote. So, as we noted a few days ago, the Washington Post believes that a state should be able to infringe a citizen's religious liberty without a compelling interest. That's the only conclusion a reader can draw from the editorial. As we have noted, the piling on continued with the governor of Connecticut, Daniel Malloy, announcing that he would even forbid travel to Indiana by Connecticut state officials, conveniently forgetting to mention that his own state has a similar law, as does the federal government. The NCAA, that is the National Collegiate Athletic Association, piled on, as did a host of sports figures from across the country. More than one pundit pointed to the irony of the NCAA trying to posture on a question of sexual morality, but the pile-on continued. Law professor Daniel O'Connell of Indiana University stated the truth plainly when he said, and I quote, "The reaction to this law is startling in terms of its breadth and, to my mind, the extent to which the reaction is uninformed by the actual content of the law." In a similar vein, Douglas Laycock, who is a professor of law at the University of Virginia, and we should note, is also a proponent of same-sex marriage, declared, quote, "The hysteria over this law is so unjustified." He went on to say it's not about discriminating against gays in general or across the board. It's about not being involved in a ceremony that you believe is inherently religious. But now, even as the dust is eventually clearing in Indiana, it's now apparent that the real issue is not the RFRA in Indiana or Arkansas, Georgia, or any other state. The real issue is the fact that the secular left has decided that religious liberty must now be reduced, redefined, or relegated to a back seat in the culture. The evidence for this is mounting, and it is dangerous. One key indicator is found in the editorial pages of the New York Times. That's the most influential single newspaper in the world. The paper has appointed itself the guardian of civil liberties, and it has championed LGBT causes for decades now. But the paper's editorial board condemned the Indiana law as cover for bigotry. The most chilling statement in that editorial was this, quote, "The freedom to exercise one's religion is not under assault in Indiana or anywhere else in the country. Religious people, including Christians, who continue to make up the majority of Americans, may worship however they wish and say whatever they like," end quote. There you see religious liberty cut down to what's now called the freedom of worship. The freedom to worship is most surely part of what religious liberty protects, but religious liberty is not limited to what happens in a church, a mosque, a temple, or a synagogue. That editorial represents religious liberty redefined right before our very eyes. But the clearest evidence of the eagerness of the secular left to reduce and to redefine religious liberty comes in the form of two columns by opinion writer Frank Bruni. The first, you'll recall, was published back in January. It included Frank Bruni's assurance that he affirmed, quote, "the right of people to believe as they do and say what they wish in their pews, homes, and hearts," end quote. Religious liberty was now redefined so that it has no place outside of pews, homes, and hearts. Religious liberty no longer has any public significance. Just to note very quickly, that is not religious liberty, as was enshrined in the Bill of Rights, and certainly not as was respected by the founders of this nation. But Frank Bruni really doesn't believe in religious liberty, even inside churches, and even when it comes to the hiring of ministers. In that first column he wrote back in January, quote, "and churches have been allowed to adopt broad, questionable interpretations of ministerial exception laws that allow them to hire and fire clergy as they wish," end quote. The ability of churches to hire and fire ministers as they wish is declared to be questionable. Remember that line when you are told that your church is promised even freedom of worship. But Bruni's January column was just a prelude to what came in the aftermath of the Indiana controversy. Now the openly gay columnist demands that Christianity reform its doctrines as well. He opened his column in the paper's edition published Easter Sunday with this, quote, "The drama in Indiana last week and the larger debate over so-called religious freedom laws in other states portray homosexuality and devout Christianity as forces in fierce collision. They're not." He writes, "at least not in several prominent denominations, which have come to a new understanding of what the Bible does and doesn't decree, of what people can and cannot divine in regard to God's will," end quote. That, taken alone, is a really interesting paragraph. It's extremely revealing. But that paragraph, of course, is not taken alone. Bruni issued an open demand that evangelical Christians get over believing that homosexuality is a sin or suffer the consequences. His language couldn't have been more chilling. Again, I quote, "So our debate about religious liberty should include a conversation about freeing religions and religious people from prejudices that they needn't cling to and can jettison, much as they've jettisoned other aspects of their faith's history, rightly bowing to the enlightenments of modernity," end quote. Well, there you have it, right in his very words, a demand that religious liberty be debated, much less respected, only if conservative believers will get with the program and, watch his language very carefully, bow to the demands of the modern age. Christianity and homosexuality, he said, quote, "don't have to be in conflict in any church anywhere." He reduced religious conviction to a simple matter of choice. In his words, and I quote, "But in the end, the continued view of gays, lesbians, and bisexuals as sinners is a decision. It's a choice. It prioritizes," he writes, "scattered passages of ancient texts all over that has been learned since, as if time stood still, as if the advances of science and knowledge meant nothing." He went on to say, "it disregards the degree to which all writings reflect the biases and blind spots of their authors, cultures, and eras," end quote. So the only religion that Frank Bruni respects is one that capitulates to the modern age and is found, in his words, and I quote, "rightly bowing to the enlightenments of modernity," end quote. That means giving up the inerrancy of Scripture, for one thing. The Bible, according to Bruni, reflects the biases and blind spots of the human authors in their times. When it comes to homosexuality, he insists, we now know better. This is the anthem of liberal Protestantism. And the so-called mainline Protestant churches have been devoted to this project for the better part of a century now. Frank Bruni applauds the liberal churches for getting with the program and for revising the faith in light of the demands of the modern age. Demands that started with the denial of truths such as the virgin birth, the bodily resurrection of Christ, miracles, the verbal inspiration of Scripture, and other vital doctrines. The liberal churches capitulated on the sexuality issues only after, and we should note this very carefully, capitulating on a host of central Christian doctrines. Almost nothing is left for them to deny or to reformulate. Now let's note this. It's interesting to see how quickly some can get with the program and earn the respect of the secular gatekeepers. Frank Bruni cites David Gushee of Mercer University as an example of one who's seen the light. Quote, "human understanding of what is sinful has changed over time," end quote. That is David Gushee, as quoted by Frank Bruni in the column. Bruni then states that Gushy, quote, openly challenges his faith's censure of same-sex relationships to which he no longer subscribes, end quote. But David Gushy agreed with the church's historic condemnation of same-sex relationships, even in a major work on Christian ethics he co-authored, until he released a book stating otherwise just months ago. Once a public figure gets with the program, whether that person is David Gushy or Barack Obama, we learn the lesson very quickly. All is very quickly forgiven. Bruni also notes that, quote, Christians have moved far beyond Scripture when it comes to gender roles, end quote. Well, he's right to understand that some Christians have done just that, and in so doing, they've made it very difficult to stop with redefining the Bible and gender roles. Once that's done, there is every reason to expect that a revisionist reading of sexuality is close behind. Bruni knows this, and of course, he celebrates it. It's very important that we take these two columns by Frank Bruni and we take them very seriously, because what they represent is a full-throttle demand for a theological capitulation and a fully developed reduction of religious liberty. In his view, and let's note, it's now stated in full, right in the pages of the New York Times, the only faiths that deserve religious liberty are those that bow their knees to the ever more costly demands of the modern age. That's incredibly revealing, isn't it? It's incredibly revealing that the verb he chose was bowing. One of the earliest lessons Christians had to learn was that we cannot simultaneously bow the knee to Caesar and to Christ. We have to choose one or the other. Frank Bruni, whether he intended to do so or not, and we can be certain that he did not, he does help us to see that truth with a new and vivid clarity. In another front in this moral revolution that demands our attention, over the weekend, the New York Times ran another article entitled, With Hire, Scouts Affiliate in City Defies Ban on Gays. It's written by reporter James Barron, and he writes, taking the first step towards a possible face-off over the Boy Scouts of America's ban on openly gay adult members or employees, the organization's New York affiliate said on Thursday that it had hired an openly gay Eagle Scout. According to the paper, the young man is scheduled now to work at a Boy Scout camp this summer. The New York group is known as the Boy Scouts Greater New York Council, and it announced the hiring of the young man who grew up in Maryland and is now a student at the College of Worcester in Worcester, Ohio. He became a prominent figure, according to the paper, among those speaking out against the ban on gay people over 18 in scouting. Richard Mason, a board member of the Greater New York Council, said, and I quote, we've had an anti-discrimination policy for a very, very long time. This young man applied for a job. We judged his application on the merits. He's highly qualified. We said yes to him, irrespective of his sexual orientation, end quote. Now, back in 2013, the Boy Scouts abandoned its longstanding policy, a policy that previously they had defended successfully all the way to the United States Supreme Court. The Boy Scouts back in 2013 changed their policy to allow for participation by openly gay scouts, but only up to the age of 18. And furthermore, the group changed its policy only halfway, dealing only with scouts themselves and not with scout leaders or with employees of the organization. When the scouts changed their policy back in 2013, we noted that the change simply wouldn't satisfy the moral revolutionaries. That's also a very important lesson for us to observe. The moral revolutionaries demand total capitulation. A halfway measure simply does nothing, or at least it does nothing but set up a total capitulation. Because those who were pushing for the Boy Scouts to abandon their policy, which had been established on moral principle, a policy that leaders of the Scouts said, even in weeks preceding the change, was fully expected and supported by the parents of most Scouts, and they abandoned convictional principle for mere pragmatic compromise. But that's the kind of compromise that won't stand, and this article is setting up a collision between the Boy Scouts organization in New York City, which, according to the paper, is not alone in defying the national body's new policy. This headline story in the New York Times serves as notice that the Boy Scouts are going to face a very significant challenge, not only from outside. By the way, while we have been watching with concern the unfolding controversy in Indiana, one of the things we've noted is how major corporations were among the very first to demand that the law be revised or withdrawn in the state of Indiana. They were among the very first to say that the Religious Freedom Bill was, in the words of some corporate leaders, bad for business and thus bad for Indiana. The same thing was true back in 2013 with the Boy Scouts of America, because it was corporate members on the board board, including CEOs of major Fortune 500 corporations who were facing stockholder action from their own shareholders if they didn't force the Boy Scouts to capitulate. And as we've seen, it was a halfway capitulation, setting up a total capitulation. It doesn't take much of a prophet to see where this is headed. There's going to be a challenge from inside the Scouts. That's what this headline's all about, as well as challenges coming from outside the Scouting organization. And having abandoned principle, there's really nowhere for the National Scouts to go but total capitulation. It will also be very telling to see what participation levels in the Scouts really represent since the change in 2013. The Boy Scouts have not been very clear about those numbers, but eventually the story will be told. Oh, and again, when it comes to the prediction of total capitulation, another evidence of that is that the new CEO of the Boy Scouts of America, and that is none other than Robert Gates, the former defense secretary, had stated that he had pushed the Boy Scouts as far as he could go back in 2013, stating that personally he wanted the total capitulation. Now, this story gives us very good advance notice that that's almost precisely what surely will come. Next, a story that reveals a great deal about the place of art and culture in terms of our society in the present. The author of this article is Hugh Eakin, who is a senior editor at the New York Review of Books. That's a very prestigious journal, one of the most important book reviews published in the United States. In many ways, it's a barometer of the cultural and intellectual elites in this country. Mr. Eakin wrote an op-ed piece for the New York Times in which he decries the fact that the Islamic State, identified in the article as ISIS, is destroying so much art and culture. He says it has to stop. In the beginning of his article, he asks, will the world do nothing to stop extremist groups from destroying some of civilization's most treasured monuments? He says this is the question that has confronted Western governments with stark urgency in the weeks since the Islamic State, he does use the term there, released a video of militants smashing ancient sculptures in the Mosul Museum. In early March, he says, following reports that extremists attacked the ancient Assyrian sites of Nimrud and Hatra, Iraqi officials pleaded for American airstrikes to stop them, but so far, he says, the United States and its allies have wrung their hands. End quote. I make mention of this article not because I do not share the concern about the destruction of cultural artifacts. That is indeed a concern. Any intelligent and caring person should care about the willful destruction of civilization. As a matter of fact, one of the things that demonstrates the nihilism of the Islamic State when it comes to civilization is the fact that it has so wantonly, strategically, and publicly destroyed so many sites of historic value in terms of civilization. No, the reason I draw attention to this article isn't because of the concern over the destruction of art and culture, the statuary and the museums. It's the fact that this is getting so much attention, while in just the previous few days, at least 147 people have been killed by Islamic terrorists just in one university campus in Kenya, and the Islamic State, the group that is targeted in this article for its destruction of so much culture, is actually far more dangerous for its destruction of human life. There is absolutely nothing wrong with being concerned about the destruction of the artifacts of civilization, with the artifacts of culture. What's really strange about this article is that it appears, in a place of such significance, making such an open call for military action, when the larger issue of the sanctity and dignity of human life is right before us in the wanton destruction of humanity and the extermination of so many human lives by the very group that is here assaulted and criticized, though rightly, for destroying cultural artifacts. There is a time to get to the destruction of culture, to the destruction of museums and art, but that's only when the infinitely higher value of human life has been established and when human lives have been defended. It's more than odd that an article like this would appear. In April of the year 2015, with the Islamic State infamous for beheading so many prisoners and killing so many people, and the big issue that attracts the attention on this op-ed piece is art and culture. It's not, again, that art and culture aren't important. It's just that right now, the overarching issue of the protection of human life should sweep virtually everything else off the moral screen. Finally, in recent days, we've been looking at a very important argument that's even reaching well into the secular world over the shutting down of free speech and free expression on America's college and university campuses. We looked at Brown University, where there was the example of students being protected and that was the word that was used, and made to feel more comfortable and safe by avoiding, by shutting down debate on issues in which certain students simply no longer see the possibility of any valid opposing viewpoint. We've also noted that, in the main, the kind of viewpoints that are being shut down are those that defend classic civilization, classic liberties, and as the California State University system, just to take one example, has demonstrated, Christian speech about the Bible and about the gospel. As I say, there are certain letters that have appeared from students defending this new kind of suppression of speech, and one of those was cited in the pages of the Wall Street Journal over the weekend. It was written by a young man who's a senior at Brown University, a member of the class of 15, and the letter that is cited in the Wall Street Journal makes the point emphatically. He writes, and I quote, "The current rally that generational pundits make against me and my peers in college today is that we have forsaken freedom of speech and multiple viewpoints for comfort. What does the word comfort even mean?" He goes on to write, "I'm afraid that it is a product of jargon that is too easily mistranslated by these opinion columnists hoping to pass a deadline. If they delved with any honest intent," writes this young man, "into the vast discourse of social justice, they would see how far from the mark they really are. To begin with," he writes, "when students claim a lecture or event is uncomfortable, it's not because the chair cushion is sagging, nor is it because we simply don't like the ideas being touted before us." He goes on to write, and I quote, "It's because the speakers promoting these ideas do not display an effort to be inclusive in their thoughts," end quote. Now, at this point, we can simply interject, what in the world would that mean? He goes on to write, quote, "When I say your argument makes me uncomfortable, it's because I am greatly concerned that you have not done the requisite thought and research into generating an inclusive thesis that considers as many nuances as necessary to deliver a sound debate," end quote. Let me just interject at this point. There is no debate left once you interject what he demands as the inclusive thesis that considers as many nuances as necessary. He goes on to say, quote, "If you do not believe that skin color, age, religious identity, sexuality, class, or disability has an effect or have an effect in cultural, political, or economic problems that we debate at universities, then it is you," he says, "who is trying to remain comfortable despite such frightening realities. In this sense," he concludes, "being uncomfortable is the strongest form of rhetoric that our millennial generation wields in the struggle against all forms of oppression," end quote. That reminds me of a cut line I saw under a cartoon some years ago in which the central character said to another, "I guess what I mean is I had more respect for your position until you explained it." That's almost the way I feel reading this letter from this young man at Brown University. When he explains his position, it makes it far worse because he really is saying that they will not tolerate speech that they find uncomfortable. And by the time they describe what that means, it's even worse than we thought. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. For more information, go to my website at albertmohler.com. You can follow me on Twitter by going to twitter.com/Albert Mohler. For information on the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, go to sbts.edu. For information on Boyce College, just go to boycecollege.com. Remember, we're taking questions for Ask Anything Weekend Edition. Just call with your question and your voice to 877-505-2058. That's 877-505-2058. I'm speaking to you from Destin, Florida, and I'll meet you again tomorrow for The Briefing.